The Monsanto Corporation breeds, grows, and sells genetically modified seeds to farmers across the world. They've been doing it for 15 years. This makes them a leader in the field, but because they also hold patents on a number of those seeds, it also makes them a target in the debate over whether seeds can be the property of a corporation. Dr. Robert Fraley is Chief Technology Officer and Executive Vice President of Monsanto. He's familiar with the passion against GMOs among some activists. He believes it's all a part of making progress.
The conversation itself around GMOs in many ways has become a distraction to the real issues and challenges and conversations we should be having around food security, because as important as the GMO technology has been, it's only one tool in an arsenal of many tools that farmers will need. And how do we double the amount of food between now and 2050 is really where the conversation should be focused.
People like Vandana Shiva and other activists who target Monsanto in their anti-GMO campaigns claim that your technology is killing people, is causing suicides in South Asia, that sort of thing. By your argument, would you say that such critics are contributing to starvation by halting the production of agriculture in the way that you say Monsanto's technology can assist farmers?
You know, in a broad sense, I mean, every new technology has its detractors. And, you know, I always often talk about the examples, you know, in other fields. So we've seen some folks in the area of human health who don't believe in the science of vaccines. And there's a whole internet rumor mill that's, you know, not grounded in science or based in scientific fact. And as a result today, you know, we have folks who are getting diseases that should have been eradicated decades ago. I was just in California, and, you know, they're now up to, you know, several hundred children, you know, being infected with measles, and several who have died because somewhere there's a story that says vaccines might cause a problem, which has never been grounded in science. You know, we see those same, you know, issues and critics that spread information, misinformation, rumors, and sometimes just lies about the technology. You know, the true story in India today is that the technology has been adopted extensively. It's given farmers, cotton farmers, higher yields, and it's also dramatically reduced their pesticide use. And this year, India, because of its adoption of the technology, will become the largest cotton producing country in the world, and Indian farmers are enjoying a level of income and sustainability that they've never seen before. You know, there's a very beneficial technology in rice called golden rice that's being developed by IRI, the International Rice Research Institute, that's based on science that was developed 20 years ago in Germany and in Europe, where a single gene can be introduced into rice to create a higher level of vitamin A, which can, you know, in diets, you know, particularly in Asia and Africa, which are poor in vitamin A, young children develop eye problems and night blindness. And there's been a lot of work to show that just a cup a day of vitamin A-enriched golden rice could alleviate this problem. You know, that's an example where activists and critics who have destroyed field trials are creating a needless barrier to the adoption of a tool that can help farmers, you know, grow their crops, but also help, you know, directly in terms of health benefits to consumers.
So why not have GMO technology identified on labeling?
Yeah, the labeling conversation is really an important one and a timely one. And we are absolutely supportive of companies who want to do, you know, the GMO-free labeling. You know, here in the U.S., remember, you know, 90% of the corn and soybean crop are GMO. So it is the base, you know, crop technology in the U.S. for consumers who want a GMO-free product, you know, we certainly encourage, you know, the use of the organic label, which by definition is GMO-free. And then there are now, you know, organizations that are certifying, you know, certain food products as GMO-free. So there's about, you know, 15,000 different products in the grocery store shelf today that are GMO-free. So, you know, one perspective is consumers already have an enormous amount of choice between whether they want a GMO-free product or not. And so a lot of the conversation around labeling tends to be driven by folks who want to create labelings that are more punitive or would be of concern to a consumer. And those are the ones where we've intervened as a company. But, you know, fundamentally, in direct answer to your question, we support the right for organizations to, you know, label their products as GMO-free. We think that type of voluntary labeling is exactly the type of approach that should be used.
But don't you contribute to the controversy by spending tens of millions lobbying against transparency and labeling bills in Congress?
Well, we're not against transparency. That was the point I was trying to make. We support the voluntary labeling systems that are already out there. Let's reel back to maybe the situation you're talking about in California or some of the labeling bills that are being proposed today. Those labeling bills, you know, I would characterize as being very poorly written. They will be very costly to implement. Everyone who has studied those has talked about their cost of enforcement to being hundreds of thousands of dollars to a family, with no benefit above and beyond what's already available with the choices from organic and voluntary labeling. And so we've opposed those, as have so many other food companies, because they're expensive, they're poorly written. And in the end, labeling is a national priority. And we would certainly support, you know, the FDA looking at a broad-based labeling approach, but to do it state by state and interfere with the transportation, with the ability of farmers to produce their crops and market them at a state-by-state level, I think would create a nightmare situation. So, you know, we've opposed those kind of poorly written, you know, state-by-state initiatives.
But are you saying an FDA GMO-free law would be something you'd support?
Yeah, and in fact, the FDA and USDA have already defined a number of the GMO-free type products. Doing that at a national level, I think, is the right solution versus state-by-state initiatives that are often originated by groups who have a different motive.
Couldn't you preempt this whole thing, though, by labeling what are GMO products? Couldn't you say, if this is such a boon for humanity, made with superior GMO-produced agricultural products for your health and the health of all mankind, something like that?
So the way the labeling systems work is we label every bag of seed we sell around the world, you know, as containing, you know, our biotech traits. So we do label all of our seed products. The challenge that you're addressing is how does the processed foods and how do the food products get labeled? You know, as a seed company, we have a role in that, but that is the ultimate decision of the food companies and the FDA. We're a member of GMA. We support the efforts that they're putting in place in terms of transparency, and we also support the efforts that they're putting in place to, you know, to try to create a more of a national, you know, labeling scheme that will work for all parties.
But nothing would prevent Monsanto from doing that. Just like Intel markets Intel inside in computers, you could market GMO Monsanto products in this, you know, burrito.
You know, we sell seeds to farmers. Those seeds get shipped to grain companies and provided to, you know, to different, you know, processors. It's really a processor decision in terms of what they want to label, you know, not a Monsanto seed perspective. And we, you know, as I said, we support, you know, the variety of voluntary labeling schemes that are out there that, you know, some companies today are already using.
You wouldn't want to leave the impression, though, that Monsanto is uneasy about forthrightly saying, we're proud of this, we think this is a great technology, and we're happy to put it not in the fine print, but right in the big print.
I'm absolutely proud of the track record in history. I mean, you know, these products have now been, you know, used, you know, for nearly 30 years in the country in you know, since their discovery in the early 80s. You know, they're used on the vast majority of the corn and soybean and cotton acres in, you know, North America and South America. They have an exceptional track record in terms of their, you know, benefits and their safety, and we're proud of the technology, absolutely. But it's still the purview of the FDA in terms of the, you know, food labeling requirements.
Do you think the science is settled on neonicotinoids, the use of chemicals that are genetically put into creatures that develop a pesticide resistance or a pest resistance? Are neonicotinoids something that concern you, their absorption into food and animal tissues?
I've looked at the science, particularly as it relates to this area of bee health, which tends to be the concern point around the neonic products in terms of colony collapse disorder. We've actually been doing quite a bit of research for the last several years on bee health, and I would say our science and the science of a lot of the scientific leaders that are studying this tend to point to a different culprit, which is the varroa mite. So if you can imagine it, if you were a bee, a varroa mite would be about the size of a football on a person. And the varroa mite is latching on to the bee and draining it of its vital fluids, but at the same time, it's injecting into the bee maybe up to a dozen different viruses, which then further weaken and kill the bee, and that's what causes the colony collapse disorder. And I think most scientists see that as the real culprit. And in fact, we are doing a lot of research in that area. We acquired a company called Biologics,
right,
that is using a new technology based on a Nobel Prize winning discovery that we think can help improve bee health, and we're doing a lot of testing to see whether we can use that that technology to eliminate very specifically the mites and the viruses. And I think there's some very intriguing leads there that I think get us really to the culprit behind colony collapse disorder.
I just want to get you to respond to something that Eric Chiavian, who's a doctor at the Harvard Medical School, former director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment, he published this in The New Yorker. A large body of scientific evidence points to neonicotinoids as the main reason behind the recent die-off of honeybees around the world. You've addressed that. As a result, the most widely used neonicotinoids have been banned in the European Union for at least the next year and a half. They're found in ground and surface waters and in the food we eat. They've been shown to disrupt nerve cell activities in mammals. I'm deeply concerned, this doctor writes, that neonicotinoids may harm humans as well. What do you say about that?
We don't sell those products, and I'm not privy to all of the information that you've talked about there. I know these products have been approved previously in Europe and the U.S., and they have an excellent safety record, and they've been thoroughly studied. I know the EU is re-reviewing the data and may reintroduce those products in another couple of years.
Do you understand how some people have a problem with thinking about seeds as intellectual property, patentable intellectual property? And so if you suddenly get a seed that might have been inadvertently fertilized by a GMO-produced plant, that you can be liable for actually using that seed if you're, in Bangladesh or somewhere like that. Do you understand how people have a concern about that?
I understand the concern. I understand how it's been used by activists, and I understand the lack of any data behind it that supports that there's ever been an issue. Here in the U.S., there was a large USDA task force called AC21 that brought together, conventional farmers, organic farmers, GMO farmers, and basically they convened for a couple of years and could not find a single incident where those theoretical problems occurred. In fact, I'd flip it all the way around and say the great strength of U.S. agriculture is its incredible diversity. So let's just take one example here. I grew up on a small farm. When we were planting corn, the first thing we would do is, were we going to plant white corn or yellow corn? Were we going to plant sweet corn? Were we going to plant high amylose corn? Some farmers were planting popcorn. Some were planting blue corn. the farmers would get together. You'd talk to your neighbor. If you were planting white corn across from a yellow corn, you'd talk about planting dates and pollination dates.
I have that problem in my own garden.
And so, and that's all worked out. And the strength of U.S. agriculture is the fact that we can, you know, even in a crop like corn that is, you know, composed of 20 different, you know, subcrops, you know, we can grow those crops and grow them successfully. The same thing has happened, you know, between, you know, conventional and GMO crops. And, you know, while there's stories that you can find on the internet, there's really been no, you know, practical implication relative to the impact of growing these crops side by side. And as a company, you know, I think the great strength of U.S. agriculture is its diversity and the fact that we can make conventional, organic, and GMO farming work side by side to give the market the flexibility it needs and consumers the products that they want.
In a recent article in The New Yorker, a Monsanto executive was asked about the branding of Monsanto in light of the recent controversy, and he admitted that, you know, we'd change the name if we could, but it's a little late for that. Is this a tough time to be a Monsanto executive, and are you sort of stuck with a brand that you're going to have to live with in this century?
Yeah, I would say, you know, when I kind of look back, I mean, you know, we were really excited, you know, with the new, you know, technologies that we were able to develop that, you know, help farmers control their weeds or reduce their insect crops and losses. And so we, you know, we put almost all of our effort, you know, starting in the late 90s in, you know, communication to farmers around the world and our customers, you know, the benefits of the products. And the communication to farmers has gone extraordinarily well. I mean, since the 90s, you know, we're selling biotech crops in 30 countries. We're reaching, you know, literally hundreds of millions of farmers. But the mistake we made is, you know, we did not have a communication path direct to the consumer. And so while we were really absent from the consumer dialogue, you know, the critics, the activists, you know, lit up the internet with accusations and misleading statements that, you know, we are now as a company, you know, working really hard to address. So I would say the big change in Monsanto the last couple of years is we are participating in that dialogue.
We interviewed a scientist a while ago, just to give you an experience that we've had. Talking very much about the bad science of GMO critics and the hysteria that they've created in terms of fears of agricultural products from Monsanto and other groups. And we got huge pushback among listeners saying, you bought a line, you've taken the propaganda. And so we asked today, I'm going to interview you. What should I ask you? This isn't scientific. But this is just a typical example of some of the questions that they ask. They're not even terribly responsible questions, but they represent an emotional chord here. Why are you strong-arming El Salvador over their using of local seeds? Do you frequently use the U.S. government to bully small countries? Why do you punish farmers when non-Monsanto soybeans land on their farm? Is he feeding the same stuff they're growing to his or her children? And they didn't use the word stuff there. What's your response to that sense out there?
Again, going back to the example on vaccines, the whole fear of vaccines, you know, was created by junk science. Here are the facts. There's 7.2 billion people on the planet today. All of the estimates say that by 2050, that will reach 9.5 billion people. We also know that we'll see another couple billion people join the middle class as world wealth increases across Asia and Africa. So between now and 2050, we need to double the food supply. It's probably the greatest challenge facing mankind. And instead of, you know, spending our time talking about, you know, the activists and the myths on the internet, we should be having the conversation about how do we use the technologies that we have today? How do we invent new ones? How do we talk about food conservation and waste reduction? And how do we really build a plan so that we can achieve, you know, food security by 2050?
Dr. Rob Fraley is the Chief Technology Officer and Executive Vice President of Monsanto Corporation. You can hear an extended interview and a transcript of my conversation with Dr. Fraley. Just visit us at thetakeaway.org. Vandana Shiva is an author, environmental activist, and the charismatic founder of Navdanya, a movement of 500,000 seed keepers and organic farmers in India. She gives rousing speeches about corporate agribusiness destroying traditional farms, but she often also makes additional frightening claims that GMOs cause farmer suicides, malnutrition, and toxic contamination. Monsanto and its scientists have made billions, she says, while millions of people have suffered.
40% of greenhouse gases are coming from an industrial agriculture and globalized agriculture. 100% of the emissions could be absorbed into the soil by doing ecological agriculture, which is the future, not just because it rejuvenates the soil. It's a climate solution. And good soils with ecological systems, robust, with the billions of microorganisms working with us, can produce 2 times more food, especially if we intensify biodiversity. That's my work in India through Navdanya. We are doubling food production per acre. We are doubling nutrition production, which is the most significant issue. So it's a solution to hunger and poverty and malnutrition. But more importantly, when farmers have seed sovereignty, when farmers do organic farming and are not blowing up money on patented seed royalties, expenditure on pesticides and fertilizers, they actually can increase incomes tenfold. Our members, who are small farmers, have done that.
Monsanto says that it is, in fact, working on the front lines of increasing food security in the world by doubling food production using its technological techniques. What do you say to that?
Well, sadly, it does very well in advertisement, but not on the ground. The technology of genetic engineering, which is what made Monsanto a seed giant, before that it was just a chemical giant that had brought us dioxin, that had brought us the toxics. That genetic engineering technology is not a breeding technology. It takes existing plants that have been bred by farmers through selection or crossbreeding or hybrids, and then it introduces, through shooting with a gene gun, a gene that doesn't belong to that plant. And so far, the majority of applications have been two traits. One is called Bt toxin, where Bt is Bacillus thuringiensis, pulling a gene out of a soil organism to now produce a pesticide inside the plant. The approval for Bt crops in the United States is for a pesticides. It's not for food crops. And the second family is herbicide-tolerant crops, where Roundup can be sprayed on plants, and the plant survives, but everything else dies. Now, not only have these not increased yields, they actually are leading to decline in yields where super pests and super weeds are now overtaking agriculture.
What do you make of the success on cotton production in India that is a result directly of genetically engineered seeds?
Unfortunately, that too is not true. The Cotton Research Institute of India, which is the premier institute, has done studies and has shown.
But the World Trade Administration says that India is one of the biggest producers of cotton, and that was never the case even 10 years ago.
No, that's not true. India was the biggest producer of cotton. Through history, we domesticated cotton. We got freedom with Gandhi spinning cotton. We lost cotton during the colonialism when cotton, based on slavery, shifted to the U.S. Then during the American Civil War, cotton production moved back to India. During the 10 years pre-GMOs was 10 years where the U.S. was subsidizing cotton up to $4 billion a year. This was the subject of the collapse of the Cancun meetings of the World Trade Organizations because the Africans said, you're killing us with this subsidy. These subsidies became issues of disputes in the WTO. Brazil won the case against the U.S. And as long as the subsidies were in place, a lot of dumping was taking place, which meant countries like India couldn't export. When it's the subsidy factor and the trade factor that was changed, India could start exporting again.
So
we were exporting
success,
before. The success is actually the removal of the subsidy distortion.
It has nothing to do with the GMOs.
Nothing to do with the GMOs at all. And where we have increased cotton production is because we've increased acreage. And it's the same story with the Green Revolution. India produced more rice and wheat, but we increase acreage of rice and wheat. And I've had debates with the Borlaug foundations that we've shown that the land and the irrigation explain the increase in production. The idea of miracle seeds and chemicals and now miracle GMOs is covering up the real roots of where production increases.
Let's talk about golden rice. You say that golden rice is actually causing deaths, whereas people claim that golden rice would, in fact, supply vitamin A to individuals who had actually needed and reduced blindness.
I have never said golden rice is causing deaths for two reasons. It doesn't exist, so how can it do anything? It's just a promise for the future. And second, we've never said that the risks of genetic engineering is about killing people. It's about causing harm. And causing harm is very different. Golden rice, my critique of golden rice is twofold. First, that it promotes the monocultures that are at the heart of the malnutrition problem, because if we grow diversity, you don't have deficiencies in minerals, trace elements, and micronutrients. Second, if you grow biodiversity and you compare the vitamin A production of the amaranth, the coriander that we use daily in our food, the curry leaves, they have much richer production of vitamin A. So just give every woman a kitchen garden and you've solved the vitamin A problem.
But that doesn't mean that golden rice wouldn't have some benefit.
No, it doesn't have benefit. If it's 100%, 300% less productive in vitamin A and your better alternatives are available, then you don't really need golden rice, particularly when the spread of golden rice within a chemical agriculture model is going to destroy the sources of vitamin A that people could have for free.
So golden rice would actually destroy agricultural production if it was allowed to be used.
Exactly. But I would add, the next miracle they're trying to come up with is a so-called GMO banana, promising to provide iron to women who have iron deficiency anemia in India and produce vitamin A for the Ugandans. And they've already rushed trials in the United States with 12 young students. 12 students eating three bananas is going to be a scientific study to impose genetically modified bananas. For India, on iron, we've shown that 7,000% more iron we can have through biodiversity. We've also found that the GMO banana is biopirated, which means the yellowness has been taken through theft from Micronesia. This, to me, is one of the biggest outrages of the false promise of genetic engineering, that at the end of the day, it's based on stealing the biological heritage of the third world, their knowledge, and then selling it as an invention. If Monsanto takes soya bean, which is an East Asian crop, puts one toxic gene into it and says, I've invented the seed, that is not creation. It is not invention. BT is a toxic gene.
Toxic to pests?
No. Now, in the soil organism, the original gene is only toxic to the caterpillar family of pests. It's not toxic to other species, not toxic to human animals. But in the plant, it is now already made toxic. And that's the difference. And there's enough science to show that it is not substantially equivalent.
But doesn't that result in the reduced use of chemical pesticides?
Sadly.
It has in India.
No, it's not true, because after the BT cotton, where a pesticide-producing gene has been added to we have more pests in cotton than ever before. Pests that were never cotton pests, the aphids, the jassids, the mealybugs, the army bugs.
But the question is, there's less pesticide use in cotton production in India as a result of the BT cotton.
If you have 300% more pests, you're going to have more pesticide use. And the one pest which it was supposed to control, which is called the bollworm, which came to India through the hybrid cotton from America, pink bollworm has become resistant. So now Monsanto has Bollgard 2, the second generation of two toxic genes. The resistance has made the pest it was targeting evolve resistance. And meantime, insects that were never pests have become pests for which more pesticide is being sprayed.
I understand what you're saying. You may be right that the pests are increasing and that eventually it'll change. But right now, pesticide use is actually down.
I don't think national data is what one looks at. You look at the particular fields where the BT cotton was grown. You talk to the farmers. Are they using less or more pesticide?
They're saying they use less.
No, they're using more. Our studies show they're using more.
All right. Well, that's sort of the hazy sort of stats.
Yes.
Who says?
Yes.
And that's part of what is frustrating about this debate. Why is Monsanto directly responsible and answerable for the suicides of Indian farmers?
You know, I have a very plain logic to this. If you say you own something then you own the impacts of that something. If you're selling a seed where you're collecting royalty in the name of technology fees and technology trade,
right,
because India doesn't allow patenting, and you're collecting that, and that is shooting up the price.
So the price pushes the farmers into insolvency. The insolvency causes the suicide.
Exactly.
Why do the stats show that farmers are no more likely to commit suicide in India these days than other professions?
No, that's not true. And again,
actually,
No, what you need to look at is the pockets. You know, if you're talking, I'm trained as a physicist. If you're looking at a phenomena and you're looking at the processes, you look at where that process is taking place. If most of the suicides are in the cotton areas, then you look at the processes in the cotton belt. You don't shoot up to national averages. So I think we just need to be far more specific. I mean, you take WTO subsidy data on exports and you don't talk about subsidies. You talk national averages, you don't talk about what's happening to the farmers in Maharashtra. I think good science is about specificity.
What public health issue is directly relatable to GMO crops?
That's what we are demanding be studied.
But there, you can say there is no public health fatality, malady.
We've never said it'll be right about fatality. We will be.
What is the claim of public health risk from GMOs that you can point to?
You have a system in this country where you say substantial equivalence. Pretend a genetically modified food is the same as a non-genetically modified food, and then it comes to ownership. You say no. We've made it for the first time. It's an invention. That's ontological schizophrenia. You can't have the same thing as novel when it comes to ownership and natural
right
when it comes to shedding responsibility.
And that's the sovereignty issue. That's not the public health issue. Can I just ask
No, but I think there's a public health issue in the fact that American public is finally saying we want to know what we eat. We need labeling laws. A simple democratic law of saying I know what's in my food. Why is millions and millions of dollars being poured to kill labeling initiatives or sue states like Vermont? Why has democracy to be sacrificed?
Monsanto says that the laws that exist now are perfectly adequate to determine which are GMO and which are GMO-free foods in the United States. What do you say to that?
Well, I trust the American public to know better about what's in the interest of the American public than Monsanto's judgment. After all, democracy means Monsanto doesn't decide, the people do.
Why can you double food production faster than companies like Monsanto using technological means to increase food production?
For one, they use technological means without looking at the overall context of what happens to the soil, what happens to the biodiversity, what happens to the pollinators. We can double food production because we work with biodiversity, we work with the soil, we work with the pollinators. There are six times more pollinators on the Navdanya farm than there are in the forest next door.
But you wouldn't deny that the increase in agricultural production over the last 20 years has something to do with the technology.
For me, technology is a tool, and you look at what did the tool do. In the case of agriculture, a tool is a very small component. The soil fertility decides how much you'll get. Whether you have irrigation or not, that decides how much output you'll have. The potential of the seed decides. The biodiversity intensification decides. The reason our systems produce more is we intensify biodiversity. And the more biodiversity there is, the more nutrition per acre there is. The industrial system, which is called the use of technology, actually destroys biodiversity, has destroyed the fertility of soils. That intensive agriculture that's producing less food per acre, it's producing more commodities per acre. But the commodities are going to drive cars as biofuel. They're going to torture animals as animal feed. That's not a food system. The first issue about industrial agriculture, it is destroying the planet. The second issue is it's giving us nutritionally empty commodities with no micronutrients, no trace elements, and that's why we have so many new diseases, which also need to be looked at much more. The impact of toxics need to be looked at much more. The third aspect is the fact that industrial agriculture, which uses 10 times more input than it produces as food, and also uses 10 times more finances than it can earn for the farmer, it's a negative economy. Farmers trapped in this negative economy is the reason family farms has disappeared. It's the reason our small peasants are being pushed off the land. When there are systems of farming that can give meaningful, viable livelihoods, that protect the livelihoods of farmers.
Very persuasive, but I fear that you're conflating the debate over industrial agriculture, which is a legitimate debate, with the debate over GMOs, which is a fundamentally different discussion.
It's not a different discussion, and I think it is time to not let it be treated as independent of the industrial agriculture system. GMOs are part of an industrial agriculture system.
Right.
GMOs don't exist in and of themselves.
No, I understand that, but mass-scale agriculture is different from genetically modified corn.
No, genetically modified corn requires a conversion to industrial agriculture, which is why we will solve these problems of fruitless debate when we realize the gene doesn't exist independent of the plant and a GMO doesn't exist independent of an agriculture system.